From listener-supported Capital Public Radio, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later in the program, a local student jazz band takes on an ambitious assignment, recreating some of the amazing arrangements that Gil Evans did for Miles Davis. You'll hear them play one of those songs in our studio. Also, Capital Public Radio's classical morning host, Kent Teeters, will have unfamiliar music from Mendelssohn, a new set of the famous symphonies by Brahms, and songs based on Chinese poems translated by Gary Snyder. But first, the lingering economic challenges in both California and Nevada are causing big problems for governments in the two states. Lawmakers in Sacramento and Carson City are struggling with their respective budgets. We're going to get a fiscal update from both sides of the Sierra Nevada. In a few minutes, you'll hear what's happening in Carson City, but we start with Sacramento and the California state government. Joining us from our downtown bureau is Marianne Russ, Capital Public Radio's Capital Bureau Chief. Marianne, thanks for joining us again today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, how does the budget look right now from the point of view of lawmakers and the governor?
It still looks like there's an awfully big deficit to solve, and no real talks are happening aimed at doing that. We're still looking at about $15.4 billion that lawmakers need to address. And at this point, we're really in sort of a holding pattern. A lot of people are just waiting for what's called the May revise. That's going to be the governor's latest and greatest version of the budget. It'll include an updated revenue picture and a new economic outlook. And in fact, we expect he could roll out two budget plans this year. One may be sort of an all-cuts scenario, and then the other may be something very similar to what we saw in January, but includes his plan for tax extensions. Now, that revise is going to come out on Monday, May 16th this year. For those of you who know your constitutional deadlines, that's actually a couple of days late. It's really supposed to be out by the 14th, but finance officials say they are waiving state law because income taxes were due a couple of days late, and they needed that extra time to finish things up.
And I guess if the governor does release two draft budgets, it's so that lawmakers and, by extension, the public could see what the two options are. If there's no more revenues coming into Sacramento, this is what the budget would look like. And if lawmakers and or the public approved extending taxes and so on, that this is what the budget would look like.
Absolutely. And in fact, that's what Governor Brown has been doing over the past few weeks as he was touring around to various parts of the state and making his case for tax extensions. You mentioned revenues. It's actually likely that there will be quite a debate over the fact that we expect a revenue bump, perhaps as much as $2 billion. It's often called a May surprise. They've been hoping for one of those for a while and haven't had one, and it looks like we may have one this year. Now, the question will be, will lawmakers want to use that extra money to eliminate cuts, or is it too risky to count on it? Because last year, there was a period when the revenue picture was looking a lot better, and then it sort of deflated. In fact, Democratic Senate Leader Steinberg said it deflated like a souffle. So we're hearing some caution on that front from Democrats and the governor. But from the Republican side, that extra revenue is sort of an argument against tax extensions. They say, hey, the economy is improving, and more taxes would hurt that. So that's likely to be a big debate.
And even if those $2 billion do materialize, while it's a lot of money relative to a $15.4 billion remaining deficit, it's still a relatively small amount of money.
You're right. And isn't that crazy that we're saying $2 billion is a small amount of money? But that is the fact of the matter. We're looking at 15.4. But at this point, you know, every dollar is to lawmakers, especially if you're a Democrat wanting to avoid cuts, if you're a Republican wanting to avoid tax extensions, every dollar is a big help.
Now, there's some legislation working its way through, or has worked its way through, the legislature that relates to the budget.
Oh, indeed. Many bills, actually. But you know, in fact, right now, what lawmakers are doing when they're not really working so much on the budget, they're working on a lot of bills. They're in session this morning, and nearly every day this week, there have been numerous committee hearings. And a lot of those do deal with the budget. One very interesting measure that passed a Senate committee yesterday would allow counties and school districts to ask voters to approve a number of taxes that they currently don't have the authority to collect. So we're talking about local income taxes, excise taxes on tobacco or alcohol, even taxes on soda and oil severance taxes, and it's not limited to those. Democrats are pitching this as an alternative to cuts. They say that since they haven't been able to get Republicans to agree to put tax extensions on the ballot to get some statewide revenue, This is another option for local governments and schools. During the committee hearing yesterday, Democratic Senator Lonnie Hancock said the expansion of this taxing authority would allow more local control.
I welcome a return to the ability of local people who care about the local places where they live to define the conditions under which they will live. I think this is good public policy.
And I guess you could say we just saw an example of that earlier this week in the city of Davis, where voters approved more financial help for local schools. But, you know, that might not happen across the state.
You're absolutely right. And in fact, that's one of the arguments that the opponents are making. There was a long line of groups that showed up to oppose the bill yesterday, from the California Chamber of Commerce to organizations representing wine and distilled spirits, you know, things that might be taxed, as well as the California Taxpayers Association. Gina Rodriguez is with the group, and she says it represents a major power shift.
Granting taxing authority and therefore fiscal responsibility to counties and school districts would in effect create a fragmented system of taxation, county against county, school district against school district.
And there was an interesting exchange, as I understand, between a Republican and a Democrat as they discussed this matter.
Indeed, sort of indicating the politics of it. Democratic Senate Leader Daryl Steinberg is the author of the bill, and he had a very telling exchange with GOP Senator Doug LaMalfa as he presented the measure to the committee. Let's listen, and you'll hear LaMalfa first.
I was just thinking we could actually label this the Make the Local Government Officials as Unpopular as the Legislature Act.
Governing's a tough thing, Senator LaMalfa.
Yeah.
Got to make choices.
Single digits.
And have it both ways.
So there you go. A little bit of tension in the room.
Yeah. So this is past committee. Still got a ways to go if it even does emerge from the Capitol. But there was a bill, a budget-related bill, that was signed into law yesterday.
Yes. And I should note real quickly, Jeffrey, that this bill being authored by the Democratic Senate leader, and the Democrats have a majority, is a very good chance that that bill would pass because Democrats are saying it's a majority vote bill.
I see.
So when you have a bill like that, its shot is pretty good.
Okay.
The bill that you referenced, Governor Brown actually signed it this week. It allows the DMV to postpone sending our annual registration bills. Now, this would primarily affect drivers who are scheduled to renew in July. They will also waive any late fees. And the goal is not to give us a break. It's to give lawmakers more time to negotiate a budget package, one that, if Democrats get their way, would include increasing registration fees. Now, the temporary higher fees that we've been paying, the ones that passed in 2009, are set to expire June 30th. So the idea behind the bill is not to send drivers a smaller bill now and then another one later, to have to make up the difference if, in fact, those fees are increased through a budget plan. So it's a little bit complicated, but for those who have renewals due in July, which I must say I am among them,
yes.
they will probably not get their renewal letter as soon as they otherwise would. So I'll be able to report to you firsthand on how that plays out.
And speaking of Governor Brown, we got some personal news about him recently that apparently he had some cancer removed from his nose. How's he doing?
Yes, well, apparently he is recovering. What happened was he apparently needed some reconstructive surgery as part of the removal of this basal cell carcinoma. His office says he won't be making any public appearances until his stitches are out. We're told that he's been working some from home and in the Bay Area. And that has actually sort of solidified the budget holding pattern a little bit more. The governor had been going out on the road, as we mentioned, to tout his budget plan, and we haven't been seeing that at least over the past week. It was, about a week ago tomorrow that he had the surgery.
Marianne Russ, Capital Public Radio's Capital Bureau Chief, thanks so much for this update.
You're very welcome.
Well, that's the view from Sacramento. Now, the view from Carson City, in other words, the budget situation in the state of Nevada. Joining us is Brandon Ruderman, who's news director of public radio station KUNR in Reno. Brandon, thanks for joining us today.
It's good to be here, Jeffrey.
Well, the things are at such a level that the governor of Nevada actually went on TV this week to make an address to the people of the state.
Right, and that was sort of our governor's version of the revised budget. What happens is there's a group called the Economic Forum. It's a bunch of business leaders that are put together, and they make the official revenue projections for the state. They did this once towards the beginning of the legislative session, which is only 120 days every other year in Nevada. So it's a little bit different picture than you have over there in California. We are a part-time legislature here. And anyhow, we're now about a month left in that legislative session, and they revised the numbers. And the governor said that he wanted to put all of the additional money. There was a little bit of a boost, about $200 million in extra revenue that they predicted would be available. He wants to put that back into education. And while Democrats agree that's fine, they say it's still not enough. We're still looking at massive cuts to the education system in the state of Nevada.
Where would the Democrats get this extra money that they think should go into education?
Well, as you and I speak, they are unveiling a tax plan of sorts, and details have been sort of leaking out in advance of that. Right now, Nevada has no corporate income tax, and corporate income tax has become the most evil idea that Republicans can think of here. So it's not being called that. It's being called some version of a franchise tax or something. They're bringing it in. But that may be phased in under the Democrats' proposal. Also, a sales tax on services has been kicked around. Right now, we only tax goods in the state of Nevada. So this would be, you know, if you go to the hairstylist or whatever, you would have to pay a sales tax on that service as well. And then there are also some tax increases that are set to expire, and that's contributing to our budget shortfall. The lifting those sunsets that would have those tax increases expire on the sales and payroll taxes is another idea that's been thrown around. And there's actually been some indication from the Republican side that there may be an appetite to do that if they get some of the things they want to horse trade for.
I see. Now, in your story after the governor's speech, you noted that Democratic leaders of the legislature did not hold a press conference, which seems a little unusual after such a high-profile and partisan event. Did they tell you why?
They didn't say why, but I think most people are speculating that the reason Democrats didn't do that is because they view it as now it's our turn to drive the ship. Sure, the governor can come back and give a revised budget. That's not really an official part of the governor's job in their eyes. It's really the Economic Forum that I mentioned, that group of business leaders coming back and saying, here's how much revenue there is, and the legislature tweaking it at that point. So they released a short written statement saying, thanks for your input, Governor. That was basically the tone of it. But they're going to move ahead. And indeed, that same day that the governor made his speech, earlier in that day, they closed a K-12 education budget with a bunch of money added back. So they've created, by some estimates, a $700 million hole in the budget. And I know these numbers don't really add up to what you have in California, but population-wise, when you factor in per capita, I mean, California and Nevada are both doing about the worst in the nation when it comes to recovering from the recession. Our overall budget is only about $6 billion. It's just shy of that for the two-year period that it's set for. So you're looking at a budget of about $6 billion. Estimates put the shortfall anywhere from $1.5 billion to about $2 billion. So it's a sizable chunk that they're having to find. And the other interesting dynamic here is we can't run a deficit. It's against the Constitution in the state of Nevada. So there's no credit card for us to break out. We got to break even at the end of this thing.
My guest is Brandon Ridderman of public radio station KUNR in Reno. Is there any reason to think yet that the economy is turning around in Nevada?
It's tough to say at this point. I think most people would agree that it's leveled off. We're not bleeding anymore. The really tough thing is, though, we've built our entire economy around gaming and tourism. And then also construction was a big portion of that because it was people moving here from California, frankly, that sort of fueled that. Now that's all come to a standstill. Property values are way down here. They haven't really shown any sign of going back up. In fact, they're still slipping in some areas of the state. Las Vegas, of course, is still hammered hard. The good news is for Las Vegas, at least, as opposed to Reno, is that Las Vegas has some international recognition as a destination. So you're starting to see people trickle back in. They're not gambling as much. They're not spending as much when they come back. And up here in the northern part of the state where we don't really have that, the best thing that we have going for us up here really is Tahoe's international recognition that brings some people into Reno. But for the most part, we're dependent on Northern California in northern Nevada to bring back the economy. So pockets of the state are really going to be hurting for a lot longer. And even Las Vegas, when it brings people back, I mean, most people have casinos in their backyards now. So you really got to want to go to a place like Las Vegas. And you've got to want to spend money in order to fix our problems.
Couple of other matters, Brandon. One of Nevada's U.S. senators stepped down officially. It was long expected, though. He stepped down on May 3rd, John Ensign. And can you remind us what his problem was, why he had to leave office?
John Ensign was involved. He admitted to having an extramarital affair with one of his staffers. In fact, the staffer also was married to another of his staffers. So a couple of people who had worked for him were entangled in this. And that led to a Senate ethics investigation. And really what that was looking at was a couple of things. The woman who he had the affair with, her husband, was helped to get a lobbying job by Senator Ensign. And also there was some money that was that changed hands between Ensign's family and the family of the woman whom he had the affair with. And for the longest time, he did everything that you do not to resign. And he, you know, people were frankly somewhat surprised at the lengths he was going to. But he was simply, he did publicly admit to the affair. He said I was wrong, and you know, sort of took the mea culpa, but never indicated anything close to wanting to step down. What it appears to have happened by the, if you read the statement that he gave when he announced that he was going to resign, is that they really ramped up the ethics investigation in the Senate Ethics Committee against him. And the pressure must have gotten to the point where he didn't think it was going to work out. Other people are speculating, well, you know, maybe there was some pressure internally from the Republican Party as well, because, you know, if they have an incumbent in that seat when 2012 rolls around, they probably have a better chance of keeping it, a Republican seat in the state of Nevada. So that really led to the resignation. What's happened since then is that Governor Sandoval has said he's going to appoint Dean Heller, who is a congressman from the northern part of the state, the rural part of the state, to that seat. So he's going to assume the Senate seat, and he'll be the incumbent in 2012. And unlike in the Senate, when there's a vacancy in the House, we have special elections in Nevada. So on September 13th, there'll be a special election. It'll be open to anyone who wants to be on the ballot. There's not even a filing fee. So we could see quite a few candidates when September rolls around.
No doubt. And we're just about out of time, Brandon. But just very quickly, a well-known person in Reno passed away quite suddenly just a couple of weeks ago, Milt Glick of University of Nevada at Reno, and also a commentator on your station, KUNR.
Yeah, KUNR is actually licensed to the Nevada System of Higher Education, and we're based at the University of Nevada, Reno. It was shocking and unexpected for a great number of people. It came at a critical time. He was one of the strongest advocates for higher education in the state. And it was really, you know, there are several colleges and universities. He was always front and center at the table advocating for the universities and their funding. He'd been here for about 5 years as president, and several big buildings have gone up in that time. It's really changed the face of the university, and it really left sort of a gaping hole in the university culture at the University of Nevada, Reno. His provost and executive vice president, Mark Johnson, has just been named as the candidate to take over as interim president, and we're expecting a nationwide search in the meantime.
And he died of a stroke on one night while having dinner.
It was on a weekend, and he was having dinner with his wife, and a sudden and massive stroke. It was completely out of the clear blue sky, and it really sent the community reeling. I was actually at his memorial service here. There was a public memorial service for him on campus, and it filled up the stands at the basketball arena here. And really just a guy who's going to be missed by a lot of people here. He did a lot of good things for the university in his time here.
Brandon Ruderman, news director of public radio station KUNR in Reno, thanks for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
This is Insight on listener-supported Capital Public Radio. When we come back, a local student jazz band with an ambitious assignment. This is Insight from listener-supported Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Some of the greatest masterpieces of jazz are recordings made by trumpeter Miles Davis and writer-arranger Gil Evans. Their work together included the famous albums Miles Ahead and Sketches of Spain. They also collaborated on some of the music on Davis's album Birth of the Cool. Evans brought intricate, lush, and imaginative sounds to his arrangements. For example, here's the song Will-o'-the-Wisp from Sketches of Spain. Thank you. Local student jazz musicians are going to recreate some of the famous collaborations between Miles Davis and Gil Evans at a concert tonight. These pieces were only recently transcribed for others to play. The musicians are all at American River College in Sacramento, and four of those musicians are in our studio, and they're going to play one of the songs, a stripped-down version of one of the songs we'll play tonight. But we'll start with their leader, their professor, Dine Effertson. He's professor of music and director of jazz studies at American River College. He's also a professional trombonist. Dine, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
How come these famous recordings and works were only recently transcribed?
It's been difficult to find the actual transcriptions or to find Gil's original arrangements. And he actually finally found them. And some of these weren't actually found. They just transcribed them off of the actual recordings. So when we were doing this project, one of the difficult things was to try to figure out how are we actually going to get this music. And it wasn't up until December of 2010 that we finally found these original transcriptions. And it was like finding a pot of gold, which is great.
I can imagine. When I listened to the arrangements of Gil Evans, they sound so complicated and they take unusual turns all the time. Is it hard to play?
It is. And actually, Gil broke the rules a lot. In fact, when he was going to record Miles Ahead album, it's against union rules to have musicians have the music ahead of time. But Gil broke the rules and actually sent it out a couple of months early to the musicians before the recording session because it was so difficult. These were top New York musicians, and they had a difficulty with it. So for us, it took a lot of work to get this down, and the students just came through, just batted a home run. So
yeah.
It's been great.
Well, as I said, some of the students are with us. Including, Dimitri Blizzard, who's a pianist.
Yeah, that's right.
What did you think? How did you react when you heard about this plan to recreate these classic songs by Gil Evans and Miles Davis, and you were going to be part of it?
Well, I'm always excited to take on new challenges, and I'm always looking for that next thing. So hearing about that, I just said, you know, let's see the music and let's do it. No matter how hard it's going to be, I know we're going to spend a lot of time on the work side. I'm not too worried about it, and we're going to see it all pay off tonight.
You are a jazz studies major
at
American River College?
Yes.
How long have you been playing piano?
I've only been playing piano for about 3 or 4 years.
Wow. Now, also with us, who's also playing tonight, is Alec Olson, who's a baritone saxophonist. Alec, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
What did you think about this project when you heard about it?
Well, I was interested in this project right away because I love the collaborations between Miles and Gil, especially for the odd instrumentation they use. I'm also a clarinetist, so we're getting some chances to play bass clarinet and incorporating some flute into the big band tonight, and I always think that's a really interesting way to go. And I'm interested in hearing how it turns out, and I'm sure it's going to go great.
You're a jazz studies major too, correct?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. Jesse Carlton is with us. He's acoustic bassist. Jesse, thanks for joining us.
Yes, sir. Thanks, Jeffrey.
Now, you're not a jazz studies major. You're an English major.
Yes, sir.
So do you keep up with these other ones?
I try.
You try.
It certainly keeps me on my toes.
How much work has this been to rehearse for this particular project, this ambitious project?
It's certainly been a chunk of work. I mean, we've got our combo here. We're doing music from the Second Great Quintet, which Miles Davis, Wayne Shorter, Ron Carter, Herbie, and Tony Williams from the 60s, which Gil Evans was a part of the backdrop. He was watching all that, and some of those changes on that and trying to solo over him has been truly a challenge working with that and attempting to recreate this free bop book that they forged in the 60s.
Yeah. And our fourth student musician is Molly Pease. Molly?
Hi.
Well, you're a vocalist, but when I think about the Miles Davis, Gil Evans collaborations, I think about instrumentals. Where do you fit in?
Definitely. It's actually great in this group. I've gotten a lot of opportunities to sing along with the instrumentalists and play the part of an instrumentalist, which is really what jazz vocalists try to do. So it's been great.
You mean scatting?
Scatting, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, why don't you get in your positions? Because you're going to play in our studio. And while you do that, Dine Effertson, could you tell us what they're going to play?
They're going to play something from The Birth of the Cool. This is Boplicity, and this is a tune that has really a it's very characteristic of the style. And what Gil Evans and Miles were going for on this was to take a big band and actually make it into a smaller sounding group to capture the breath of a big band, but in a nonet form. So we're going to do that with four people today, though, and make it a little bit even smaller.
So it's a stripped-down version.
Yeah.
Of Boplicity, and it's with four jazz musicians from American River College playing live in our studio. Take it away. Wow, that was tremendous. Live in our studio, four jazz musicians from American River College, vocalist Molly Pease, baritone saxophonist Alec Olson, pianist Dimitri Blizzard, and acoustic bassist Jesse Carlton. They and others will be playing a concert tonight at American River College with arrangements, classic arrangements by Gil Evans from his work with the jazz trumpeter Miles Davis, Diane Effertson. How big will the band be tonight? This is a stripped-down version.
Stripped-down version, and we have two big bands, and we're adding in, the typical big band has about 18 people in it, but we're adding three flutes, bass clarinet, we'll be adding clarinets to it, two French horns, which is fabulous sound. Gil loved to write for French horns and have them actually lead many of the phrases. So it brings together a lot of folks. So we're talking sometimes maybe 25, 26 people on stage per band.
Wow. And you got someone who's played at a pretty high level also playing
yes.
tonight, a former member of the Count Basie Big Band. Who is he?
Andre Rice. And Andre, this was an amazing discovery. One day walking into the ensemble comes this trumpet player, and we got to talking, and I said, so what's your background? He goes, well, I played with the Basie Band for 8 years. My jaw just dropped, and I'm thinking, oh, okay. He's going for an education degree. He played and now wants to go into education. And so he came in, and I kept it kind of cool with him. I didn't really want to exploit that whole thing, but I thought, we're going to do this Miles thing. He's got to play that part.
And you've got a pretty cool setting for the concert tonight.
Yeah, we're going to make it look like the 30th Street Studio in New York City, the Columbia Studios, where they actually recorded this. So we're going to have, it's just going to look like a big giant studio that they used to have, those big cavernous studios.
And Dimitri, are you guys all going to be dressed in appropriate clothing, zoot suits or whatever?
I don't know about those suits, but me and Alec are pretty much dressed right now. We have a theme for the whole band, which is pretty much just all black
to
make
cool.
it look a little bit more uniform.
Yeah, very nice. Well, thank you all so much. The concert starts tonight at 7:30 at the American River College Theater. Dine Effertson and all the rest of you, thanks so much for joining us today on Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thank you
thanks,
so
Jeff.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Thank
this
you.
Is Insight on listener-supported Capital Public Radio. When we come back, this week's Sound Advice. This is Insight from listener-supported Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Tomorrow, how scientists and doctors are using patients' own cells for a personalized form of stem cell medicine. And a Placer County couple returns home after spending 6 years in Cambodia helping to fight human trafficking. It's time for our weekly music segment, Sound Advice. The first Thursday of the month, it's classical music. And joining us with some new and interesting recordings is the morning host on Capital Public Radio's classical station, Kent Teeters. Kent, welcome back to Insight.
Hey, Jeffrey. Good to be here.
Well, what are we going to start with today?
Mendelssohn, and not the usual Mendelssohn, some rather unknown Mendelssohn to many people. Mendelssohn wrote some of the world's best-known music, his a famous violin concerto, his Italian symphony, the Hebrides Overture, and his music for Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, all mainstream, all core repertoire music. He also was a child prodigy. Mendelssohn wrote a lot of music when he was a teenager, still kind of finding his way, finding his own unique musical language, music that is not so well known. There are a pair of concertos for two pianos dating from his teenage years. Both of those double concertos are featured on this 2010 release from Ohm Records. This is the finale from the E major concerto for two pianos by Mendelssohn, performed by the Silver Garberg Piano Trio and the Bavarian Chamber Philharmonic. Christopher Hogwood is the conductor.
I guess in parts it sounds like earlier than Mendelssohn, you know, the interaction between the pianos and the orchestra could even be Beethoven.
Or even as far back as Mozart.
I was thinking the same thing, but I didn't want to go quite that far, but
I think so. I mean, he was still finding his voice, and certainly, you know, the sounds of Beethoven and Mozart were in his ears. though these pieces are not the composer's, not Mendelssohn's most important works, they provide a pleasurable listening experience and really give a solid glimpse of the young Mendelssohn still working his way and finding his own sound.
And I loved that run in the piano that happened early on in that clip. Very nice. My guest is Kent Teeters from the Classical Station, and this is Sound Advice. So that's some less familiar music by Mendelssohn. Who's next?
Well, some modern music, but with a very accessible sound. And we need to talk about this a bit and talk about beat poet Gary Snyder, who translated the works of what I like to call another beat poet, not a modern poet, but a beat poet who lived during the Tang Dynasty in the 9th century. His name was Han Shan. As a young man, Han Shan left his family and wealth at about age 30 to take up the life of a hermit poet and settling in a remote cave beneath a rocky cliff. And it was from this mountain retreat that Han Shan took his name, which Han Shan means cold mountain. Han Shan's poems poke fun at the establishment and celebrate nature, and the Taoists and the Zen Buddhists claim Han Shan as their own. So you can understand why Gary Snyder, who is very much into Zen Buddhism and has an affinity for Han Shan.
And who lives in the Sierra foothills, just in case people aren't aware of that.
Oh, I hope to have the opportunity to meet him while he still treads this earth. He writes wonderful poetry of his own, but these translations are of Han Shan's poetry by Gary Snyder are just wonderful. There's a new recording of songs by several composers that use Snyder's famous translations of Han Shan's poetry. The CD on Innova Records is called On Cold Mountain. This is a portion of the first song from that CD. The music is by Roy Weldon, who is a member of the string quartet involved. The words by Han Shan, as translated by Gary Snyder. The musicians are Karen Clark and the Galax String Quartet.
It's very beautiful.
It's lovely, isn't it? You would not, you know, I set it all up and you would expect a very much an Asian sound, but
yes.
To my ears, it sounds like American folk music almost.
Yes, it does. You know, we've been hoping to entice Gary Snyder to come on our program Insight for many years now. So hopefully this will build a little bit of capital playing such a wonderful musical version of these beautiful translated poems that he wrote. Well, that's very nice. We're gonna go back in time again now, I guess.
To Brahms. Roger Norrington is best known. He's a conductor. He's best known for his orchestral recordings made mostly in the 1980s and 1990s of Baroque, classical, and romantic music using either antique instruments or instruments of vintage design. And he's an advocate of what is called the historically informed style. playing in the manner that the composer would have heard it. These days, Norrington uses kind of a modified hybrid version of that style with the Stuttgart Radio Symphony Orchestra, the same type of sensibilities, only now using modern instruments and still having the string section play with almost no vibrato, a technique that makes for a very transparent kind of sound. This 2010 release from Hansler Classic Records is of the complete four symphonies by Johannes Brahms. Roger Norrington conducts the Stuttgart Radio Symphony Orchestra. Here's a part of the third movement from the Symphony No. 4 by Brahms.
And Kent, for the benefit of non-musicians, when you talked about the lack of vibrato in the strings, that's that vibration that the string musicians add with their left hand as they're playing, holding down the strings.
That's correct. That's correct. And it makes for a very crisp, transparent sound. The woodwinds, as a result, the woodwinds and the brass seem to come through to the foreground. And at times when they're playing these symphonies, this group sounds almost like a small chamber group of musicians. It's a very nice approach to the four symphonies by Brahms. Some of the critics love the approach. Some hate it. I like it. I find it quite nice.
Kent Teeters, morning host on Capital Public Radio's classical station, joining us for sound advice. Kent, thanks so much for bringing this great and varied music.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison.